can matter. How much time would you like?
3 minutes. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Counsel, can we agree on the use of terms and not being disrespectful at all to your clients, but for the sake of clarity, can we refer, as you have done, to each of the Kim family members as Market Kim and Restaurant Kim? Would you agree to that?
I think that would be wise. It took us a while at the trial court level to land upon that so that our arguments could be understood.
You're reserving 3 minutes.
I am. May it please the court. I am Doug Shepard. I represent the Restaurant Kims. The two issues are whether or not there was substantial evidence of an implied easement presented at the trial and whether or not there was substantial evidence of a prescriptive easement. I believe the standard, because there were 27 months or almost 28 months between the time of trial and the time of entries of findings of facts and conclusion of law, is that this is a de novo appeal. I cited a case that indicates there would be no reason for deference to the trial court in that they heard or understood the testimony when it's 27 months later. Whether it's de novo or substantial evidence, the cases are not even disputed on appeal except for the standard of the prescriptive easement. We're arguing for a standard of clear, cogent, and convincing evidence because there is a recorded case that indicates it's clear evidence, and I've cited all the other jurisdictions that use the term clear, cogent, and convincing evidence. I would admit to this court that the law on that one issue is not clear, and I would argue whether it's clear, cogent, and convincing evidence or by substantial evidence, the prescriptive easement still fails. And this is the first time, using an analogy that I hope the panel thinks is appropriate, I've had a trial court after a...
You would agree that if this court adopts the view that the trial court did, that there is an implied easement by use, that we need not reach the prescriptive easement?
I guess the answer is yes, okay. Because I don't think you can decide both that the light was red and green. Either there's an intended easement or there's...
So perhaps you might want to address the implied easement. And it appears that the only true challenge is to the third factor, necessity. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And you're relying on Allen for that proposition?
I'm relying upon the facts for that proposition. If the panel were to look at the case, this is the first time. Can the panel hear me? This is the first time
I've looked. You need to be near the microphone.
It's the first time I've looked at a case where the parcel, and I'm going to call the market as parcel one, is claiming that they have an easement by necessity because they need to have access over an adjacent parcel when there's 150 feet of public roadway.
Well, you're asking us to revisit the facts, and although you've challenged many, many of the findings, you haven't addressed them in your brief. So I think your primary challenge was to the effect of the Allen case and a different standard for necessity, reasonable versus strict.
And whether or not it has to be at the time of the trial or at the time of the gift.
You're advocating 1978 is the date.
That's correct.
What case do you rely on?
Cogswell, I believe, at 81 Washington 315, it's necessity at the time. And because I didn't respond to Your Honor's earlier comment, I do believe I addressed it in the brief, but the issue of necessity is addressed by the time of the grant and whether or not the parties intended, and I do believe that I briefed that Volt gave a deed to Beebe through a law firm without any reference to a reserved easement. They later gave a 11-foot easement to Mariner over the south part of the property without any...
Are you talking about the other third parties?
Yes.
those matters are not before us, though, right?
I believe they go to the intent of the party at the time of the granting, and I believe it goes to whether or not there was believed to be a necessity at any time during the course of those deeds. In other words, if there...
Your argument essentially is if they thought this was necessary since they were tidying up easements in 78, they'd have tidied this one up, too.
Absolutely. In 1982, when they addressed it, they would have tidied it up. In February 8th of 1982, Exhibit Number 6, they would have taken care of it. In 1983, with the correction deed, they would have taken care of it. In 1984, with the lease of the market, they would have taken care of it. In 1996, when they gave the property to my clients, they would have cleaned it up if that was the intent of the parties. And in 1997, when they transferred the parcel one to the market Kims, they would have, at some point, if the intent was back in 1978 to have an easement, they would have referenced that easement at some point in some of those documents.
These are family members, though. It was owned by mom and dad early on. They had it for over a decade, and they used it for the same purpose it's currently being used for today. They quit claimed the restaurant portion to their daughter, and they continued the same use over both properties, didn't they? And isn't that what the trial court found?
I feel like we're moving into the prescriptive easement now, but...
Well, actually, I'm still on the implied easement.
I apologize if I don't understand your question. They did, in fact, share their properties and allow people, by consent, to park when they were using Parcel 2 on Parcel 1 and when they were using Parcel 1 to park on Parcel 2. The change occurred in 2003 when my client, the restaurant Kims, were able to get rid of a 30-foot easement that went down the south side of the market parcel in the north part of the easement of the restaurant parcel. At that point, they were told to keep their trucks off the property. There was consent. I don't believe there was evidence of necessity because the testimony was they delivered to the north part during the time that the market was leased.
But you're challenging factual findings that the court made, so the only question then for us is whether substantial evidence, and you don't address that in your briefing.
Well, I apologize. I disagree. I believe the reason I put the arguments in as regards the deeds and the use was that there's no evidence of necessity. I mean, I believe that, or reasonable necessity, I guess, even...
Is your position now that it's reasonable necessity and not strict necessity?
No, I believe it's strict necessity, but I believe there wasn't evidence of reasonable necessity even. I believe it's strict necessity at the time of the grant. I believe that's what the law is, not at the time of the trial.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes left.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Peter Dworkin, and I represent the Market Kims. I believe this case has been briefed adequately, and I think the court, based on the questions I've just heard, has boiled it down, at least in my opinion, to the issues that I see are relevant. First off, I feel strongly in this case that the appellant has failed to adequately raise the factual challenges that were brought or at least are being argued here today. And I think on page 23 through 25 of their reply, they essentially admit that. They agree that they did not cite to any relevant portions of those findings to indicate what they were challenging. They also agree that they failed to attach those findings to their opening brief. And then when you read through the guts of the brief, because I understand we're not always form over function, being the one who had to respond, it was extremely difficult for me to discern exactly what facts were being challenged as not having substantial evidence. I believe that the citations we've put in our brief do point out all points in the record that adequately explain the trial court's findings. As this court knows, and as I know, recently I lost a case challenging findings. It doesn't matter that there may be disputed evidence in the record. What matters is that there is evidence to support the version of findings that the court entered. I will agree that the appellants here did place some evidence in the record that may at some level challenge some of the findings. However, the court didn't enter findings in their favor. And if the court reviews the record as a whole here, the exhibits and the testimony, I think the court will find that the findings of fact are supported by substantial evidence in the record. With respect to the question that was asked regarding the prescriptive easement, I do adhere to the position in our brief that if this court finds there is an implied easement, the issues raised regarding the prescriptive easement need not be addressed. The court can see from the ultimate judgment of the trial court that the scope of the easement are identical. So it was simply the legal theory upon which it was granted. So I don't intend on addressing prescriptive easement here unless the court has questions for me.
I got a question on the easement by implication. The trial court didn't use a strict necessity standard. If we were to find that the law is that a strict necessity standard is required, is it your contention there's sufficient evidence to show strict necessity?
Yes, it is that my contention.
And how do you respond to, I think it's the point the appellants make, that there is vehicular access to the north side of the building. I think it's the north side of the building, the other side of the building.
Sure. Well, that question is, the answer to that question depends on the definition of strict. And unless the only evidence or indication I have is what strict means are the cases that I've read, and that would be the Adams versus Cullen case, the progeny that have arisen out of that, and also Professor Stobuck's iterations on what necessity means in regards to implied easements by reservation. So my answer to the court is everything that I can see in terms of authority indicates that necessity is a balancing of use versus necessity. So when we say strict necessity, what we're also looking at are the facts entirely as to prior use. The stronger the evidence of prior use, the less evidence of necessity is required. So my first...
Can we look into the economic cost of the alternative as well?
Yes. My first answer to the court is there's enough prior use here. We don't need very much necessity. But for argument's sake, let's assume the evidence of prior use was weaker and we need a stronger level of necessity. The necessity we've shown is that at the time this case was tried, there were many inconveniences to the operation of the business that were previously allowed, and then the financial cost of transferring the movements to the other side of the building were extensive.
They'd have to move the loading dock. And can I just interrupt you? With respect to the factual presentation on necessity, I think one of the sons testified about the cost, and there was no rebuttal evidence, nothing challenging the cost, which looks like it was close to $500,000 to move that loading dock.
Your Honor, yes. The son of the party respondents here, Mr. Sung-Soo Kim, testified at trial, and it was uncontested at trial, that in order to efficiently change the operation from the loading dock side in the middle to the other side where the opposing counsel has showed that there's a potential other access, they would have to repave the parking lot. That would cost about $100,000, including entitlements, because it's within the shoreline jurisdiction. This property is literally, you have Birch Bay Drive, and then there's the water. It's right on the waterfront. And then the efforts required to remove load-bearing walls and man doors within the building to move the loading dock to the other side was estimated about $200,000 to $250,000. So I think the uncontroverted testimony was that to effectively change the operation and keep it as efficient as it was originally would cost about $300,000 to $350,000, was the testimony, and there was no rebuttal to that evidence. And so with respect to necessity, yes, I think the cases do indicate, in fact, as far back as Adams versus Cullen, one of the issues that was looked at in that case as evidence of necessity was the cost of building a driveway. And so financial costs can be taken into necessity, strict necessity, and the answer to get to the issue.
That would tend to cut away, it seems to me, from an argument that it's strict necessity. If you're looking at costs, you're suddenly looking at what's reasonable rather than is it possible.
Well, Your Honor, I can give you my opinion as to why it's not strict necessity. I haven't necessarily found a case that says this, but I think Professor Stobuck has...
I think I just gave you a reason.
Well, that's one reason. Well... I do embrace it, and I don't think it's strict necessity. And the other reason I would say is we already have an ability to get an easement when it's just strict necessity and no prior use, and that's through private condemnation. So if it were strict...
The case law there has said reasonable necessity most recently, not strict necessity, and has looked at economic factors as well.
I think you're, again, making my argument for me, and I do appreciate that in the sense that I think the facts here support the necessity. With respect to any other evidence that the plaintiffs cite to, one of the primary issues they cite to is the lease. Again, unless the court has questions about why I believe the lease is more probative of our situation as opposed to and the prevailing issues that the trial court decided on, I don't have anything further for the court. I think the court has hit the nail on the head in its questions to the appellants, and the trial court should be affirmed. Thank you.
At least we agree on the case, and that's Adams, and I guess we read it differently. Adams, as I read it, said it's not difficult to state that there must be reasonable necessity for the existence of an easement by implied grant and strict necessity for the existence of an easement by implied reservation, and we have an easement by implied reservation. Admittedly, the Adams Court and courts thereafter have some difficulty in applying what strict...
My question would be, why would we ever care about the cost if it was truly strict?
The one court that asked the court to look at the cost, I'm not quite sure why you would look at the cost. I'm very disturbed as to why you would look at the cost at present. I do believe it's whether or not it was necessary at the time, okay. And we don't have any evidence as to the cost of moving it.
But whether you look at the cost at the time of the grant or now, once you start factoring in the amount of money, aren't you engaging in some kind of reasonableness analysis?
You know, without any other cases applying that analysis, I don't know how we move away from strict necessity, but it is another way a court dealt with strict necessity with one additional factor. I don't believe it goes to the cost presently. I believe it also goes to what the intentions of the parties. It's hard to see what the court was doing, but the court might have been looking at the cost to try to determine what the parties intended. The problem I have in this case is in 1980, they signed a lease, which developed a practice first of delivering to the north side when they say it's inconvenient or can't be done. We put in evidence that, in fact, for years, they have had large trucks delivered to the north side. And then they put in a lease where they kept for the family for summer purposes this whole loading dock that they claim now is necessary. So from 1980 until 1997, there was a lease which is in existence that indicated that the parking for the people that were running the market would be to the north. Along the north edge of the building. The term of the lease was for 20 years. They agreed that the parties, that the lessor, that's the people that kept the place that they claim is necessary, and their children shall have the right to use the 20 by 40 foot warehouse in the southern half of the 20 by 48 warehouse during the term of this lease. So they kept.
Your time runs out. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's fine if you have questions.
I know you're arguing the facts here, but can you respond to the EVIC case, which is a Supreme Court case, EVICH, that says the prevailing rule is that the creation of an implied easement does not require absolute necessity, but only reasonable necessity, adopting the majority view. There is a minority view that you're advocating, but Washington has adopted the majority view.
Well, it didn't strictly overrule Adams, I don't think, and I don't have a response in the time I have. I do believe that it has to be something different than a granted implied easement as opposed to reserved. And if we take that case where it appears to be taken at this point, you're using the same standard for both of them. You're allowing somebody to give a deed and keep a secret as to something they're reserving. There has to be a different standard, would be my argument, for one reserved.
Thank you.